Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Some basics, perhaps, as we get started. One, today's jobs report was either good or eh. And two, and I apologize in advance, but sometimes the economy just makes no sense. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Friday, the 2nd of December. Good to have you with us. And we're going to begin, as we usually do on the first Friday of the month, with the numerical basics. The Labor Department reported this morning the economy added 120,000 jobs in November. That's good. It also changed its mind about the totals for September and October. More jobs were added those months than we thought. Good, yes? A separate survey told us the unemployment rate fell almost half a percentage point to the lowest it's been since early 2009. Yes, also good. As always with the labor market, though, the basics are rarely enough. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports from New York.
28-year-old Jason Linker got laid off from his government job a couple of years ago. He managed to stay pretty upbeat until he realized he'd been looking for work for a year with no luck.
And it just sort of hit me that it had been that long. And for probably a month, I was feeling depressed and just lazing about the house and doing nothing. It was just a horrible feeling to be so kind of useless.
The good jobs report today isn't all good. More than 300,000 people say they've stopped looking for work and are no longer counted as unemployed. Tom Nardone is an economist with the Bureau of Labor Statistics.
Part of it was due to an increase in employment, and part of it was due to a decline in the size of the labor force.
Still, Nardone points out the unemployment rate in the U.S. is now 8.6%, the lowest it's been in more than 2 years. And some parts of the economy seem to be coming back to life, says Ken Goldstein, an economist with the Conference Board. He says retailers are starting to add jobs, more than usual for this time of year. Goldstein says that could be a sign the longtime standoff is ending.
Consumers are waiting on business to hire, and business is waiting for consumers to start to spend a little money. And we are spending at least a little bit more money. We are seeing at least a little bit more job growth.
Unemployed Jason Linker resumed his job search and recently felt that momentum. He landed a healthcare job with the Maryland state government. He starts next week.
It's really tremendously exciting. It feels really great to be part of the economy again.
As the job market continues to grow, economists hope some of the people who had given up the search will re-enter the fray. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Just because a minute and a half isn't really enough time to do the American labor market justice, that's where we're going to start our weekly wrap of Wall Street and beyond today. For that, we've got Cardiff Garcia with us. He's from the blog FT Alphaville. Also, Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine. They are both in our very cozy New York studios. Hey, guys. Happy Friday.
Hi, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
So riddle me this, Cardiff. How come the stock markets didn't make more of this today, this jobs report?
Well, I think the details were mixed, number one, as you just pointed out. And number two, because to the extent that this begins to instill confidence in people, I think it's a very kind of fragile confidence. Because what this report really showed was that things are getting a little bit better, but just not nearly quickly enough, given the severity of the recession that we're still trying to recover from. So there's an awful lot going on. I think markets are still very nervous about what's happening in Europe. And it's going to be a pretty busy month, even for the holidays.
Lee, what's your sense on the whole average person thing? You know, I mean, Stacey had a guy in her spot who was out and now he's in. How are people perceiving the labor market, do you think?
I think they've settled into just the new reality. And I think today's market reaction, it's like finally we had a market reaction in tune with what it should have been, which is, you know, okay, measured. We didn't like soar just because there was a change from the number 9 to the number 8, which is, you could argue, you could really misread that to euphoric levels. So I think we've learned that the average, you know, person knows a lot more about the mechanics of how the job report is calculated now. So,
Yeah.
But I do think that this is still a very big problem that's not going away, and I think most people know that.
All right. Also, a problem not going away is this whole thing in Europe, and there have been meetings, you know, literally more meetings than we can count, Cardiff. I want to ask you, though, if we are now seeing what you might fairly call the denouement of this whole thing. Are we at, to quote Churchill, not the end, not the beginning of the end, but perhaps the end of the beginning of this whole thing?
Oh, we'll see. I mean, look, if there's one thing that European policymakers have shown themselves good at, it's that they're good at generating a little bit of momentum and then squashing it just as everybody's starting to get a little bit excited about it. So there's a huge summit next week when we're going to find out a little bit more. But right now, you still have the same problems of political fractiousness all throughout the continent. It's not clear that they're solved. So we've been hearing some sort of encouraging noises this week, but we've heard them before. And until we get some more detail next week, I think it's best to hold judgment. And no, I don't necessarily buy that the markets were right on this week. Markets can be silly sometimes, and sometimes they can even be stupid.
Well, let's elaborate, right? The Wednesday, the Dow was up 500 points because central bankers Lee said, hey, listen, we're going to give you all the cash you need. Is that not the solution or what? I mean, what?
And that's definitely not the solution. It's a Band-Aid. I mean, it's like the European version of a Band-Aid. It buys more time. We are a lot closer to the edge than we were in this whole crisis 6 months ago or 18 months ago when it first started. So I think the relief from that is what sent the market soaring.
But wait, here's the thing. We all knew where the edge was 18 months ago. Everybody looking at this knew where the edge was. And yet we've gone back and forth and hither and yon about this thing. And now when it comes to the crunch, we're 8 days out from the edge and we're still trying to figure this out.
Well, it's not, I hate to say this. It's not us. It's the European leaders.
Yes, that's true.
It's a disaster, really. And we did know, well, we did and we didn't know 18 months ago. I mean,
I knew. Did you not know?
Well, it wasn't so long ago that the idea of a Greek default was the absolute worst case scenario.
Oh, yeah, that's true. You're right.
And just yesterday, the UK government is starting to tell its banks to prepare for a euro failure. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, that had never been uttered before. So I think the stakes are a lot higher now just because we've pushed it so close to the edge, close to the end.
Cardiff, does this thing get fixed, the Eurozone?
Oh, God.
No, really.
I don't know. I'll tell you what.
Oh, and you have to do
my guess is that it won't get fixed next week. But if there's some reason for hope, it's that European policymakers probably want to go home for their families for the holidays, just like the rest of us. So they might find a way to kick it into January. My best guess is no, it doesn't get fixed next week, although we might make some sort of unsteady progress.
Oh, man. All right. Cardiff Garcia from the blog FT Alphaville and Lee Gallagher. I always forget who it is, Lee, when you're here. Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine. I'm so sorry.
That's okay.
Have a good weekend, you guys. We'll see you.
You too.
Thanks, Kyle.
Thanks,
bye.
Kyle.
All right, so last night down in Washington, the Senate voted down a one-year extension of the payroll tax cut. That's the 2% break on payroll taxes that a lot of people got starting last January, and it expires at the end of this month. If it goes away, average workers are going to pay nearly $1,000 more in taxes next year. President Obama and most members of Congress agree that now's not a great time to be raising taxes on middle-class workers. There is, A, the economy, and B, oh yeah, an election coming up. But politics are never easy. So we asked our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale to explain why it's so difficult to reach a deal on something that so many politicians agree on.
The payroll tax is 6.2% of a worker's salary. It goes to the Social Security Trust Fund. This year's tax holiday cost the trust fund $120 billion. And President Obama proposes to expand the tax breaks next year, which would cost the fund more than twice as much. Not good for a government retirement program already under financial strain. But economist Eugene Sterley at the Urban Institute says if the tax break isn't paid for, the trust fund is supposed to be shielded. And that means
the money that comes from income tax revenues or from borrowing from China will be put into the Social Security trust funds. So the trust funds will end up with the same amount of money.
Still, Social Security supporters worry that political meddling with what has been a dedicated stream of money to help Americans in their old age is under threat.
Franklin Roosevelt was absolutely prescient and right when he said he put the payroll tax into Social Security so no damn politician can ever scrap my Social Security program. That's an exact quote.
Eric Kingson is co-director of the nonprofit Social Security Works.
There's a long-term cost to the extension of the payroll tax, so-called holiday, and it is that it potentially undermines the financing of Social Security.
President Obama proposes to pay for next year's break by taxing people earning over $1 million. Republicans would rather freeze federal pay and cut government workers. So far, they can't agree. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Speaking of not agreeing in our political system and that election coming up next year, we've compiled a bunch of information on the economic platforms of the eight, count them, eight Republican presidential contenders, their plans for health care, education, and, of course, the U.S. debt. It's all on our website, marketplace.org. Click on that little box that says GOP contenders. We've got little cartoons there, too, for you. Strong start, so-so finish at the corner of Wall Street and Broad today. Quite a week, though. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Forget for a moment the debate over the Eurozone, the back and forth over the payroll tax cut, and the background noise of the 2012 elections. Forget, in fact, everything that has happened in exactly the past decade. 10 years ago today, Enron filed for bankruptcy. Remember them? It was a big deal. Almost $64 billion in assets, thousands of jobs, millions of dollars in retirement accounts. And where has it gotten us? Commentator Bethany McLean has these observations.
Enron's bankruptcy was the biggest in corporate American history, and it was immediately clear that this wasn't just an implosion. It was a scandal. The Enron story leapt off the business pages to become part of the country's cultural consciousness. Today, it still is. Which is odd, because Enron was quickly supplanted in size by WorldCom and in executive excess by Tyco. Who can forget Dennis Kozlowski's $6,000 gold and burgundy floral shower curtain? And after the financial crisis, shouldn't Enron seem quaint? But Enron still stands out because, of course, Enron was first. Up until that point, we believed in the permanence of big companies. They had their gleaming skyscrapers and their multi-billion-dollar balance sheets. Surely, the solidity conveyed by such things was real, and thousands of jobs and billions in savings couldn't vanish almost overnight. We also believed in watchdogs, in both the ability and willingness of boards of directors, rating agencies, investment analysts, accountants, and regulators to do their jobs. We believed that Wall Street did something of value, even if we weren't quite sure what it was. After Enron, the world seems so much grayer. Really, should anyone be shocked that Wall Street turned bad mortgages into securities that they sold their clients? After all, Wall Street helped Enron camouflage its problems for so long. And we believed in a market that was sort of like a just power. The market was supposed to reward those who built good things and punish those who didn't. But it was Enron that showed that there's a lot of money to be made not by building a real company that will be around in 100 years, but rather by generating short-term profits. You can sell schlocky products like subprime mortgages, or you can abuse accounting rules. You could juice your company's stock, get out while you could, and say, "But the accountants and lawyers told me it was legal." In short, Enron was a watershed moment in American business, and not in a good way.
Bethany McLean is the co-author with Jonah Serra of A History of the Financial Crisis called All the Devils Are Here. Her book about Enron, which is worth a read, is called The Smartest Guys in the Room. People have been meeting in Durban, South Africa this week. It's the latest United Nations go-around on climate change, scientists and policymakers working out all the minute details. This weekend, the business people show up. CEOs and bankers and sustainability executives have their own meeting, separate from the United Nations. But the sustainability business isn't just this weekend. Almost any day of the year, you can find global business leaders talking climate. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Eve Tro reports.
Opportunity Green is an annual business conference in Los Angeles. Reps from big companies, small startups, and environmental nonprofits discuss things like energy efficiency and supply chains. Then they mingle around a solar-powered DJ station with organic gourmet snacks and earth-friendly beer cups.
That's all compostable.
The rock stars at this green party are the VPs of sustainability for brands like Starbucks and Nike. Nonprofits want to convince them to save more water or curb pollution. Green entrepreneurs want to sell them on new ideas. And the big guys want to win new clients, too. Workers for American Apparel sew organic cotton t-shirts on site. Marketing manager Anais Vandenbosch says the company's here to sell its sustainable production model.
Proposing to young designer or small company to produce their garment in our factory.
The industrial paper company Domtar is here to talk about its Earth Choice line. Brand manager Louis Fix says his clients want clear-cut tools to reduce paper use, energy bills, or carbon emissions, and firm data to count that savings. He says everyday shoppers may be confused about what's truly green or not, but global corporations can't afford to be.
The business side of things is at a more advanced stage than the consumers are.
It's become good business to buy paper that doesn't come from endangered forests or hybrid cars for your corporate fleet. Companies want to get out ahead of environmental issues so they're not blindsided by some lurking PR disaster, and maybe even cut some costs in the process. Manish Bapna heads the World Resources Institute. He works with business leaders, more of them every day.
Increasingly, we're seeing many businesses look at sustainability in terms of profit, in terms of opportunities for new markets or innovation.
This is a profound business shift. Think of it as going from short-term defense to long-term offense. And the companies that have learned to play green are already making more money than the other guys. Karen Solomon founded the Opportunity Green Conference 5 years ago. She calls corporations the driver for change.
We're not seeing policy in Washington shift, but when large Fortune 500s or Fortune 50s make shifts, it trickles in ways that are unimaginable.
They start those shifts at events like hers, or Fortune Brainstorm Green, or Business for Social Responsibility. For veteran environmentalists, this can be hard to get your head around, the idea that business is going to save the planet, voluntarily. Manish Bapna at the World Resources Institute says for the most part, companies are picking the low-hanging fruit, getting more efficient, trimming waste. It's sincere, but nowhere near enough.
We need to see reductions of greenhouse gas emissions on the scale of 80 to 90% in the next few decades. We absolutely do need to see government policy create the long-term certainty that businesses need.
Bapna says there's been another huge shift. Big corporations have started to lobby for climate change regulation because now that they've started down the road of sustainability on their own, they need better maps to see where they're going. I'm Eve Troe for Marketplace.
Coming up,
countries in the least amount of financial crisis, you know, could get their all-star footballer on a higher denomination bill.
Hey, there's a way to save the euro. But first, let's do the numbers. Around 7 billion shares were traded today, but Wall Street's bottom line hardly budged. The Dow Industrials stayed right on the center line, closed less than a point from where it began at 12,019. The NASDAQ gained less than a point, ended virtually flat, 2626 the number. Same for the S&P 500, shaved off less than a point, wrapped up the week at 1244. Man, that's kind of amazing, isn't it? Those numbers don't really reflect the stock market's stellar week, though. It's best in more than 2 years. Since Monday, the Dow advanced 7%. The NASDAQ jumped more than 7.5%. The S&P 500 gained just shy of 7.5% for the 5 days gone by. Financial shares, yeah, they did pretty well. Morgan Stanley surged ahead nearly 7%. J.P. Morgan Chase checked in with a 6% boost. Citigroup shares deposited more than 4% today. Bond prices fell, pushed the yield on the 10-year T-note up to 2.03%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on factory orders for October. Reps from major and minor league teams gather in Dallas for the baseball winter meetings. And the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention hold a briefing on the flu and vaccination rates for the current season. Achoo! I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. That's American Public Media. I'm Kai Ryssdal. This has been quite a week for the equity markets. All three major indices finished the week way better than they started, thanks mostly to that wonderful Wednesday they had. Down in the data, though, there was something else that kind of got buried in all the hoopla that day. Disney bumped its annual stock dividend to 60 cents a share, the biggest boost it's had in 20 years, and which, along with some other bold dividend increases, is being read in some quarters as a vote of confidence in the economy. Here's our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon.
An extra 20 cents a share can add up. For Disney's biggest shareholder, the estate of the late Steve Jobs, it means an extra $27 million. And it may be a signal that goes beyond how well Disney is doing. Barton Crockett watches the media conglomerate for Lazard Capital.
A lot of people have been worried, are we going to enter a double-dip recession? This tells you that Disney thinks the answer is no. They feel good about the world.
In fact, there's a growing list of companies raising dividends lately. Starbucks better than 30%, Union Pacific more than 25%, Home Depot by 15%. During the worst of the recession, companies hoarded cash. Some started buying back stock to raise their share value for investors, but now they're committing themselves to direct paybacks. Mark Hulbert is editor of the Hulbert Financial Digest. He sees it as a signal of longer-term confidence.
They're saying, not only am I confident I don't need the cash I currently have in the bank, but I don't think I'm going to need it in the foreseeable future, and now I'm willing to increase my dividend and create this expectation of more permanence.
Professor Ronnie McKayley isn't so sure. He studies dividends at Cornell University, and he points out when the economy was booming in the 1990s, companies didn't pay many dividends. So he wonders if this just means they don't have anything better to do with their cash.
When prospects maybe are not as good, they may give more money to their shareholders and invest less because the economy is not growing as fast.
Then again, maybe we're making too much of this. It could just be as simple as rewarding members of the Mickey Mouse Club.
Why? Because we like you.
I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
I'm gonna sit right down and write myself a letter.
All right, your turn. Commentator Robert Reich took on the payroll tax cut a couple of days ago, and what he called the basic bargain, companies paying workers more so that workers can help the economy grow. Ken Report got in touch from Highland Heights, Ohio, to say amen.
This money would surely be spent on consumer goods, housing, and the like. It would provide exactly the kind of broad economic stimulus which the government would like to do, but which is constrained from doing by its own budgetary woes.
Our coverage of Black Friday, Cyber Monday, and the Shopathon that this time of year seems to have become brought a response from Adam Webster of Van Cleek Hill, Ontario, Canada. He says the obsession over post-Turkey Day sales figures ignores some bigger questions.
One is the notion that we need to have growth forever, because that itself really needs to be questioned if we're going to build a sustainable, intelligent economy. Number two, consumption, so long as it's linear and leads from basically China to the Apple Store to the landfill, really doesn't get us long-term repairs to our systemic problems.
Finally, speaking of the landfill, my interview yesterday with Thomas Hayden about crap technology brought shared stories of our listeners' old but underrated products. Michael Morris wrote from Stockton, California.
I myself have a 96 Subaru Outback that never gets broken into, and a 5-year-old Samsung flip phone that has been through hell and back 3 times and still works perfectly. A friend of mine has gone through 6 iPhones in the time that I've had my Samsung phone.
You can send us your thoughts via whatever technology you have, except maybe pen and paper. That doesn't always work so well. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on the link that says contact. It seems cruel irony to say this, given how things are going over there, but the euro is about to celebrate its 10th birthday. And even though fully 17 countries use the physical coins and bills that were introduced on New Year's Day 2002, there may not be much to celebrate, which we thought is kind of sad. So we wondered how best to restore confidence in the single currency. Sally Herships has that story.
What if we gave the euro a makeover?
Europe builds bridges and inspires hope. It enables its people to look to the future with confidence.
At least, it tries to.
Right now, the only information that we have about the euro is about financial data, fear, or power.
Mark Gobe is CEO of the Emotional Branding Alliance.
And what is a brand? You know, a brand is about hope. It's about You know, it's about giving a sense of a better future. The message is off substantially.
Aside from the euro's promotional video I just played, Gobi says the euro may be beautiful, but the politicians behind it aren't. Time for a makeover. Jason Kernovich is creative director at graphic design firm Heads of State. He says it's simple. Reward countries doing the best financially by letting them promote their soccer stars on their bills.
Countries in the least amount of financial crisis, you know, could get their all-star footballer on a higher denomination bill.
And countries whose finances aren't so hot, like Greece, their stars go on smaller denomination bills. Another idea, capitalize on European fashion. Trend forecaster Catherine Mollering says let Karl Lagerfeld and Versace redesign the euro.
It might become incredibly tiny one season, incredibly large. It might become embellished. It might become minimal.
But let's hope it doesn't become minimized in value. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, which if I hadn't read it in the New York Times, I would not have believed, but here you go. Donald Trump, yes, Donald Trump, is going to moderate a Republican presidential debate on December 27th. It's going to be a partnership with Newsmax, the conservative magazine and news website. I feel like I should say something else here, but I can't. I don't know. So that's it. That's all we got. That's Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. Today, the Dow shaved off less than a point, a tiny fraction of 1%. The NASDAQ up less than a point, closed basically flat. Same for the S&P 500, whittled away less than a single point. Kind of an amazing day, actually. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's acting producer is Megan Larson. The executive producer of the broadcast is Deborah Clark. JJ Yore is the vice president and general manager of Marketplace Enterprises. Coming up this weekend on our personal financial Marketplace Money, come on, how hard can managing your money really be?
Nick Knack loves cereal. He goes over to the researcher with three pieces, puts down a metal token he's been holding in his paw, and grabs the cereal. This monkey is using money.
Even a monkey can do it. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourself a great weekend. We'll see you back here, same time, same channel, on Monday. This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.